Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host and intrepid guide, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today on this journey are two-thirds of the Wrong Reel podcast trio. Coming at us via Skype, we have Mikhail Karadimov and James Hancock.
Hello.
Hello.
Say hi. Do you guys just quickly, do you want to talk about your podcast, Wrong Reel?
Yeah, Wrong Reel, we're a New York-based podcast, and we started last fall, and it's, basically, there are a lot of great podcasts out there about film, but one thing we noticed is that there are not a lot of New York film podcasts, so we cover a lot of retrospectives at the MoMA and the Film Forum and things like that, and we interview New York-based filmmakers, and obviously we review a lot of things that are coming out as well, but it's just your typical hardcore cinephile, cinemania podcast for anything and all things related to film, whether it's the latest new release like Kingsman or a 100-year retrospective on Orson Welles, so yeah, we cover it all.
Refined awesome. Analyses mixed in with some irreverent-based humor.
Yeah, if you find that most podcasts are too soft and fuzzy for your taste, we are going to dial things down for FlixWise, but it's one of the most foul-mouthed, infantile, juvenile podcasts out there. However,
I would just say abrasive. Use like a good, use a good solid SAT word, abrasive.
But we cover really, really challenging, interesting material. So if you need a mix of like the profane and the divine all in one, Wrong Reel is your podcast.
Yes,
all
absolutely. Right.
And we've been teasing this collaboration for a while now, so I'm glad it's finally coming to pass.
Yeah, we had an epic encounter between podcasts in LA in, I guess, late January. And so, yeah, it was we're thrilled to be here because this is our first collaboration with another podcast, so we couldn't be more flattered and excited that you invited us to participate.
Yeah. A little cross-pollination. Never did anyone harm.
Cross-pollination, if you will.
Absolutely.
We will.
All right, first up, we're going to talk about the 29th greatest movie of all time, Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker. This is the third Tarkovsky movie to appear on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. That's three in the top 30. We'll see how well Stalker matches up with Tarkovsky's previous entries, Mirror and Andrei Rublev. Then, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel chatty. For our second segment, we're going to talk about cinematic depictions of the apocalypse. We're going to talk about some of our favorite versions of The End of Days and why movie audiences are clamoring for the death of our species. But before things get too doom and gloomy, we're going to finish off the show with a few final notes of positivity. All right, guys, you ready to go from sepia to color?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Let's do it. First up, it's Andrei Tarkovsky's 1979 psychological sci-fi film, Stalker. The movie is set at some ambiguous time in the near future. We are told that 20 years prior to the events of the film, a meteorite crash landed on Earth, and everyone within the vicinity of the crash site mysteriously disappeared. And it wasn't just the impact of the crash that eviscerated the bodies. Others who entered the site long after the impact have also vanished. Out of concern for public safety and just general fear of the unknown, the government cordoned off miles and miles of the surrounding area, now known as the Zone. In the intervening years since the meteorite collision, all traces of civilization within the zone have been reclaimed by the Earth, and there's a sentient force which continues to lay traps for anyone who dare enter. However, there are a handful of men who claim to know how to sneak past the guards and the traps. These men act as coyotes for people who want to see the zone for themselves. They're called stalkers. And why would anyone want to venture into this creepy and deadly landscape? Well, apparently, if you can get in deep enough, there's a room in the epicenter of the zone that will grant those who enter all of their deepest wishes. The main plot involves a stalker leading two men, known simply as the writer and the professor, into the zone, but none of them quite know what they're in for. Okay. Phew! Do you guys like Stalker?
I really love Stalker. I was completely blown away. I'd actually seen Stalker once before, maybe 2003 or 2004 at the New Art. And either just due to youth and stupidity or all the mind-altering substances I would occasionally indulge in back then, I had almost no memory of the new movie apart from a few shots from the tunnel. So I kind of got to see it with fresh eyes, and I was thunderstruck. I was completely riveted, and for me, I'm a big sci-fi junkie, and there are very, very few sci-fi films that I feel like have a lot of ambition or a lot of ambiguity or poetry. And this is one of those movies that really reaches as high as a film possibly can, but also under the veil of sci-fi. Most science fiction is thinly veiled fantasy, whether it's Star Wars or Guardians of the Galaxy. It's, you know, it's a lot of magic, and there's not a lot of science fiction. And if you like literature, there's books out there like Frank Herbert's Dune, which really make your imagination go to incredible unexplored territory. And I feel like this film by Tarkovsky absolutely deserves to be mentioned in the same breath with the greatest novels in the history of science fiction. So, yeah, to put it in a few words, I was blown away.
Yeah, I was just as amazed. But it reminded me of this video game I played when I was younger called Myst. It was a PC game, and then the idea behind it was that you're just like in this abandoned world that no one else exists in, and you just do puzzles as you roam around. And it really, the notion of there being not a single other person on this planet really bothered me. So you would hear like the wind whistling through the leaves, or the fog would come rolling in, and you were afraid of what it would like present to you and its mystery. And I think he captures that so perfectly as soon as they get into the zone, that ambiguity that you mentioned earlier. And it just, it's one of those movies, again, like Wim Wenders flicks, which we talked about in one of our latest podcasts, that it makes my brain, you know, wrestle and tumble around a little bit. I have to fill in the blanks on my own and kind of add to the story as he describes it to us too, and I really appreciated that. And on another level, the performances were great and the cinematography was gorgeous, and just, he clearly knows how to play with sepia tones and then how to just bring it into color without jarring you too drastically. And it's a wonderful movie from top to bottom. Yeah. If I were to also put into a few words. Yeah. How did you feel about
that?
But
they're so pretty.
Oh, absolutely.
They're so pretty. But I mean, some have called him ponderous. Those people are wrong. it's not unfair, but I get so much pleasure watching the films. It's not like Bresson, which are like so unrelentingly bleak. There's so much hope, and there's so much, he's so earnest. I mean, I have so much admiration for all of his work, and it's so beautiful.
Also, I think it's important to have filmmakers out there who really make you sit up and are, I mean, you know, present an incredible intellectual challenge to even start to wrap your head around it. I mean, I love Stalker, but I will not pretend that I fully have digested or like assimilated everything in the film yet. And there's still, I'm trying to work my head around. But I almost feel like at age 38, it's like a great cure for like Alzheimer's or like mental complacency, having a filmmaker like this who's like, you know what, you got to climb this mountain before you're going to understand what my film is all about. And he really makes you, you can either be intimidated by the challenge or you can embrace the challenge, but there's enough in there that I find deliriously entertaining that it's absolutely worth the trip every time.
Well, I think that one of the things about him is that he doesn't give you an easy answer, and that's why he has, you know, these three characters who kind of symbolize in very allegorical fashion three very different opposing views. You're not sure by the end of the film which one you're supposed to walk away with, because they're all flawed in their own ways. And for the longest time, you assume that the stalker, who is actually so in tune with nature and the zone and who knows how to respect it and treat it like a, I don't know, its own being, at the end, you find out he's just kind of pathetic and he can't live without it, and he doesn't know how to take care of his family because of it either. So you're not quite sure who to align yourself with. So all you're left with at the end are questions that you have to figure out on your own. And that's why, and I appreciate that about him as a filmmaker, and I get that sense from most of his movies.
Quick question for Lady P, and I don't know if you do spoilers or not in reviews. Are we allowed to do spoilers or?
Spoil away.
All right. I asked Mikhail this question last night because I'm still trying to digest this. Very end of the movie, they're sitting outside of the room, they're not entering the room, and then you hear the sound of like an incoming train.
Well, describe what is the room for?
Yeah. Well, the room is where your greatest wishes have the potential to be granted.
Fully
and
realized.
They've gone through this incredible journey to get there, and they've decided not to go in. And there's this incredible transition back to the world outside of the zone, where he does all these amazing shots where the camera's kind of floating across over the surface of water. And he does it earlier in the movie, but here he does it. You see a fish swim into frame. You hear the train coming, and then all this black oil kind of spreads across the water. And then you cut right back to the bar outside of the zone.
You also see man-made artifacts down there also.
Yeah, and I thought it was one of the coolest transitions I've ever seen on film, but I literally have no idea how to interpret it, have no idea what it's telling me, and I asked Mikhail, and I can't really even remember what your answer, but I want to know, Lady P, how did you interpret that bit?
Well, I guess, like, the floating on water, and there's so much religious symbolism throughout the film. And so I sort of interpreted it as some kind of religious allegory, or at least like either, you know, like Jesus and the fish. Oh, he made fish. Whatever. That's my the extent
like
of my
deeply,
religious
deeply
studies.
Deeply spiritual yeah. person.
Exactly. You know.
She's religiously aligned.
You know, there's Jesus. There's a fish.
Exactly. There's some fish yeah. involved.
Made some yeah. food or something.
I think there was a cow at one point.
Precisely. But sort of the destruction of that. Of the spiritual, back, we're leaving the spiritual realm back to reality, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's very jarring.
Well, and one it's of being poisoned. Yeah. Poisoned.
That's why one of the things that I noticed. I think the reasons why he does shoot all the scenes in the beginning at the end when they're in the town, that very industrial town that's been just rotted away by its own sort of technology and things like that. I think that's the purpose. Of that is that transition is you're going over the water and it's supposed to be nature and the zone's all about nature and has it has a mind of its own, but then you do start to see man-made artifacts and the chipped tiles and then the oil starts to spread over the water like a sort of corrupt, like a corruption of it, and then you like get transitioned through the if you'll remind me of what that classical music piece that they're playing.
Oh, you're talking about Ravel's Bolero?
Yeah, and it just transitions into, you know, quote unquote civilization, where people should be acting normal and there is all this art and culture being created from that also. But that being said, I mean, it is, it's just corrupting. That's why the zone, they don't know what to do with it. We don't know what to do with nature. I mean, we ourselves don't know how to interact with nature anymore, especially us city kids, right? And so that's,
yeah.
I guess I projected a lot of my own, poop upon it, I suppose. But yeah, that was,
I'm gonna slap you with the ruler.
I guess you're gonna have to bleep that one out. I'm sorry, Lady P.
That's okay.
But that's how I read that scene, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so what do you make of the zone? Is the zone, like, is the zone paradise? Is it hell?
I don't know, because it does fight back. It has taken people's lives. And
well,
I think it's just
you're obsessed with Russian history. I mean, I feel like you would probably have some political interpretations of what the zone.
Well, I mean, a lot of, I mean, just think of, I mean, a lot of it. They do talk about the atomic age in this film too, and the scientists and the physicists, and they're discussing we should just blow this place to kingdom come, so that no one could really.
I think it represents an escape also for the Russian people. I mean, this is the last film Tarkovsky finished in Russia. His next film, he decided to scrap it halfway through when the Russian censorship bureau realized he was shooting a film that had not been submitted to them in screenplay form, and he made his last two features abroad. But I think it almost represents, like, this is an outlet beyond Russian censorship, Russian enforced atheism, and it's just like, I think it's like it's this yearning to have something beyond the reality that they're experiencing.
I mean, even more directly as to what was going on in the country at the time, since we were so far behind in the atomic race for, like, you know, the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb and all these things. They were working at such a speed that they never figure out how to dispose of all this, these chemicals and things like that. So they would just run it off.
Well,
into
I know where
rivers
they disposed it. They clearly disposed it on this movie set. Like all the the set design in this is just drool inducing. Like all like the melting like slag
in the tank that's covered in all vines.
I don't know how that. I mean, he must have found like a nuclear like facility where there had been like some sort of meltdown, because all the metal throughout all the tunnels and all the locations is all like
corroded.
I mean, it's the most fascinating location you've ever found. And even better, what I love about it, they completely sell the idea of the zone. I mean, most of the zone is just beautiful photography of like nature reclaiming over technology. But the way they talk about how it changes and shifts and how you can't go backwards, it's so compelling and so convincing. My imagination was like, wow, the zone is like this incredibly like, you know, intricate place. No special effects, no anything. It's just dramatic tension. They're selling you this idea of the zone, and you buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Well, now, I mean, now that we're talking about it, and this is what happens on our podcast too, I have these revelations while I'm talking, but it is, it's just kind of like, you know, since the zone and the room is specifically about you get exactly what you wish for, your deepest, darkest desires come to life, even if you actually superficially wish for, like, your brother's health, as they mention in the movie, you're actually going to get your darker intentions. And so one of those things is, yeah, what happens when nature is fully harnessed so that people could do whatever we want with it, like the atom bomb? It can potentially destroy people. So our deepest, darkest secrets and wants, we could destroy people with that. I think it kind of leads into that notion of it.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, yeah. Let me ask you guys, did you ever, during the course of the movie, think of The Wizard of Oz? Did it ever recall The Wizard of Oz for you?
Well, the transition from, you know, obviously The Wizard of Oz goes from black and white to color, and this goes from sepia to color. There's that very clear technique that's being employed. But for me, The Wizard of Oz is so family friendly and so innocent, and it's just like a lovely little fairy tale. Whereas this, I was horrified and mesmerized all at once. As soon as they were getting on the cart and they're going to the zone, and it's right before the color change, and you're getting the shots from behind their heads, and there's this incredible sound design and some terrifying music.
I was
moving closer and closer. I was basically sitting 6 inches away from my TV screen with my mouth hanging up and like, this is the coolest stuff I've ever seen in my life. And I was completely getting sucked in. And I don't feel that in Wizard of Oz. I feel like I'm going on this amazing journey, but it's like reading a lovely fairy tale to children as they're going to sleep. Whereas this, I was going into a dark, foreboding place that I couldn't take my eyes off of.
That's funny. I love that it's the Soviet version of the Wizard of Oz. Like, that's a total Yakov Smirnoff joke.
Replete with jokes about comparing writing to squeezing out a hemorrhoid and things like that. Like, people always talk about Tarkovsky being humorless or like joyless, whatever. But there is some dark humor in here. Even like, there's a one bit where the phone suddenly rings. When
I know
close
the phone
to the
rings.
Ring, and I started just howling with laughter.
And no one's paying attention to it.
Yeah,
at
it's
first.
Just a very strange, dark, sardonic sense of humor. But the humor is there.
So, what other Tarkovsky movies have you seen?
We watched Andrei Rublev yesterday, which is incredible, but very, very different. It's and
brutal.
I saw The Mirror at New Art as well, that same time that I saw Stalker years ago. And we actually watched Ivan's Childhood last night. I'm dying to see Solaris. I'm dying to see Nostalgia and The Sacrifice. But I'm very new to Tarkovsky, and I couldn't be more excited because I'm obsessed with film history and obsessed with guys like Bergman or Wells or, like, you know, or Louis Buñuel, the big giants of cinema. And now I realize I've got a giant that I've been neglecting and ignoring for all these years. And so I've got, you know, movies to watch and rewatch and homework to do and books to read. So, I got a full head of steam on Tarkovsky right now.
Absolutely. I've only seen Ivan's Childhood. But Ivan's Childhood, as we were noticing yesterday, has a very distinct stylistic difference. I mean, you see some of the burgeoning techniques, so like the long tracking shots and the dollies and things like that, but he had a more energetic cutting style then also, especially when they were celebrating the victory of the war.
And conventional.
Well, because it leans into that idea that it's a propaganda film too. He tried
even
his best
like
with
music
that.
Cues that feel almost like a 1940s Hollywood movie with like a Max Steiner score cue, and I mean, obviously then it'll cut to like people that are like dead and hung
from a tree.
But there are beats that
and there's
feel
a love
more
triangle
like,
too.
Like a mainstream Hollywood movie.
Absolutely.
And then the transition Andrei Rublev is stark and profound.
And I think we should probably discuss those tracking shots and just the amount of time he'll hold on a take also, because you hear a lot of times that directors, they like to try to avoid affected performances by giving actors the time to breathe in their performance by making these longer shots. Paul Thomas Anderson loves to do like slow zoom-ins on one dialogue scene and so they could just kind of get used to it. He does that a lot, but he doesn't just do it for his actors. He does it for us, too, so we can get mesmerized and absorbed into the shot. And I was wondering how you guys feel about his technique and what it brings to the table for you.
Well, I think that you kind of nail it, that it does give the actors – it does add this, like, more naturalistic feel. And also, it allows us to really get a good look at the shot. Mm-hmm. We really get a chance to really see the mise-en-scène, or whatever you want to say. Yeah, how'd you like that for Frenchness?
No, Mikhail and I always fighting about that.
Mise-en-scène.
I'm fond of correcting his pronunciation, and he gets very irritated.
Anyway.
I mean, also, so much of his films are meditative exercises, and we really get a chance to reflect on the events of the film, what's happening during the course of the film, and I think so much of it, I mean, Mikhail, you mentioned like you had a very personal reaction to the film. You were able to incorporate some of its scenes into your own life. I think that the time that that we are given to absorb everything is very conducive to that process. And I think that's very intentional for Tarkovsky. And he said that the reaction of the audience is why he makes films. Not about himself, but about people he knows. And so in a sense, they're not autobiographical, but they are biographical.
Doesn't The Mirror have a lot of autobiographical elements?
And he
got labeled almost like a political undesirable by the powers that be in Russia at the time for the content of The Mirror. And that was like one of the first steps towards his eventual departure from the country.
Precisely, yeah. I think when he said that he is that his films are not necessarily autobiographical, he was responding to criticism, or maybe not criticism, but it was responding to questions about whether or not Mirror was autobiographical. I remember in his book, Sculpting in Time, he talks about reactions that people had to Mirror and how they're very, very, they're deeply felt reactions and how people do incorporate, you know, images of, this doesn't so much pertain to the long takes, but like the images of spilled milk or kerosene lamps, or just so recalls and evokes images from people's childhoods and people's own lives. And I think that it's all, every part of the film is meant to elicit that reaction.
Yeah.
And it's funny how even in the 21st century, it's still, while it doesn't bear much resemblance to my childhood, at least the production design doesn't, it still is so evocative.
I mean, the I think his films are still, in a very calculated way, I don't think that this is something he accidentally stumbled upon, but they are vague movies still. There is enough room for you to just kind of come to your own assumptions. I think this is a good time to bring up the characters and how, yes, they're pretty well fleshed out characters, but they are clearly, they have these philosophical underpinnings to, they have very different outlooks on this room and what they would do with it. You know, the stalker doesn't even want to dare go in there because he's afraid that it'll reveal all his human indiscretions and things like that. The writer all of a sudden does get confronted with the idea that all he's been writing towards his goal are just vapid. He doesn't know why he's writing. And then you have the scientist also, who also wants to kind of rid the world of all its evils too. And just, how'd you guys read these characters and what they brought to the table? And if you had a favorite one also.
I don't know if I had a favorite. I'm inclined to say the writer because that particular loss of faith in not necessarily a higher power, but loss of faith in one's own ability to make sense of the world. Yes, yeah. Precisely. That is an immediate concern of mine. Not to get too personal, but. Yeah, I think he was probably my favorite. The professor remained an enigma throughout. I was never, even when it's revealed that his intention is to blow up the room, I could never really get a handle on what he was about. Was he petty? Was this out of professional jealousy that he was doing this?
Also, I love how as a scientist, he's just refusing to believe that the room actually, or that the zone has the ability to change. I mean, he leaves his backpack behind, and they warn him and warn him and warn him and warn him. There's no going back the way you came. And he's just like, and he does it anyway.
That's not, but, well, initially, though, when the writer decides to kind of just split off from the group and walk in a direct line to the house, he does stay behind with the stalker, and he's like, just listen to this guy. He's been here enough times to know better than what you're about to do. So It's weird. He does have this back and forth relationship with the zone. You're never quite sure where he lands on it except till the end when he doesn't blow it up.
Why do you think he wanted to blow up the zone or the room, and why do you think he decides not to?
Well, I think what his issue is that he thought by blowing up the room, it would create an atmosphere of hope. That's how I was kind of reading. He was thinking that too many sort of people with villainous intentions would be coming there and abusing it for their own just selfish gains. And I think one of the things he thought he was doing is that he would actually create a sense of hope if he would destroy the source of evil. But then, as the stalker explains it to him, it's like, no, this is hope. Like, you know, striding towards a goal in life, towards an ambition, that is the hope. Once you have attained what you wanted, what's life all about? You're not moving anywhere. The momentum has been totally eradicated.
It's the journey, not the destination.
And I think he realized that that moment, that if I blow this up, people have nothing to pray to. They have nothing to pray for. And so why would I do that?
Right. So the professor, theoretically, the most discursive of the lot, he's the one that ultimately comes down on the side of faith. And that's really interesting.
Well, given, the science versus spirituality,
precisely, yeah. So, like, is the writer then in this dichotomy, is he the spiritual one, or is that the stalker? No one is explicitly spiritual.
I think it's hard to give anyone that label because they kind of veer in and out of faith
waver,
and skepticism, which is what's so interesting about it, and just seeing kind of like, it's like they got a rubber band that all three of them are kind of fighting over, and it keeps kind of pulling them all in different directions.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's so hard to, you don't finish wrestling with this movie. It exhausts you as opposed to the other way around. I will never be able to figure out this movie. These are all just kind of like, you know, sort of pseudo-intellectual meanderings that I'm going through right now. I don't know if any of it's valid.
I think it's hard to talk about a thinker and a poet as profound as Tarkovsky without coming across as pretentious and pseudo-intellectual because he really forces you to digest incredibly weighty topics. But now I'm glad that I finally reached a point of maturity where I can at least pretend to have an appreciation, but I know that my appreciation will only deepen as I revisit his work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the ending. One of my previous guests on the show, Martin Kessler, brought up the similarity between the ending of Stalker and the ending of 2001, A Space Odyssey, where you have sort of alien
the next
space
stage
children.
Of evolution. Yeah.
Yes, precisely. So I wonder if you guys might want to make that comparison as
my
well.
My dream is that one day someone will make a superhero movie as profound and mysterious and complex as Stalker. Because at the very end of that, first thing I thought of was Jean Grey. I was like, this is the X-Men.
It's an origin story. It's a very long, 2-hour, 40-minute origin story
for the world's first mutant.
And, I love it.
Yeah, if only someone could make a superhero flick on that level. And I was even asking Mikhail, I was like, when do you think someone will have the ambition to make a superhero movie that is also artistically rigorous and complex?
Well, I think the problem is that the temptation of making just a straight up superhero film and the kind of the results that you see from that financially is too desirous to try to actually make a sort of intellectual form of that, you know, because you probably won't see your money back if you try to make a 3.5-hour superhero philosophical flick like that.
But I do think the comparison to 2001 is apt. It's basically, it's the whole movie is just a preface to the next stage of human evolution with the giant star baby. And when she started moving those glasses at the end of the movie, it was such an exclamation point on what was already an amazing movie experience. Even without that scene, I would have been in. But to have that as the final scene of the movie, I was like, all right, you just completely won over my heart because I am a superhero junkie, and so it just sealed the deal.
So what do you think of it? How does it relate to the rest of the film?
All I know is that it's referred to at some point when another scene that's kind of interesting is the scene right before that, leading up to it, is the monologue, not even a monologue, but a soliloquy coming from the wife, where she starts to describe the pains involved of being married to a stalker. And she's like, and then I wasn't also aware of the type of children I would have or would be provided if I married a stalker. And then, of course, it's fully answered what she means by it. I don't know what to make of either of those scenes because she's addressing the audience all of a sudden as if she's aware that we're there. Like, we are those celestial beings that they're all referring to somehow. Since he is in love with cinema, he might be making a sort of assumption about it, too. I have no clue. I don't know. And then she's pushing the glasses at us. I don't know. I have no clue. That's like, I'm going to have to take another year.
And then the glass falls and cracks.
Yeah, that's what's so fascinating about it. You have no idea what to make of it, but you can't take your eyes off it.
Absolutely.
Just that the mystery will keep you coming back for more.
Well, so what is your initial impression? No.
Like, I think every good I've gone to a couple of churches where there was a good priest or a pastor who is very much not denying us the world that we actually live in. He's aware of the realism and the things that we have to deal with as people from day to day. And there is that good just like back and forth struggle of like, yes, this is what you should subscribe to and this is what you should strive for. But this is the real world, and I understand that you're going to fall into these trappings, and it doesn't make you a bad person, it just makes you more human. That's what he's trying to get at. There are still things mysterious about religion that we're not meant to understand. If God's a real entity, why should we assume that we'll understand the mechanisms behind it? The whole point is he's living on a whole other plane of another dimension that we can't comprehend or fathom, and I like kind of letting all my intellectual BS – I like letting it go and going down that stream.
That's
how
I worship
attracts.
Thor, because he's easy to understand. Just blonde-haired dude with a hammer and keeps my religion simple.
But yeah, like any good religion and like any good priest does actually understand is you have to struggle with this notion and you have to kind of just give yourself to it and not necessarily understand all of it. Because life is beautiful when it's mysterious, not when you have all the answers.
All right. I like that answer. But before we end this topic, I've got one more question for you.
Just one more.
I don't want to, I don't want to exhaust you guys too much. We got another topic.
We are inexhaustible.
Yep.
So, is this film worthy of the 29th spot on the Sight and Sound critics poll?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that as I was going through the list today that I have not seen most of these movies. I'm still a fairly young chap. and I'm still getting into cinema that way.
You, quick interruption for Miguel. Lately, just out of curiosity, before you started your podcast, how many of the 250 had you seen?
You know, I don't remember. I think I'd seen about half of them, I believe.
All right. Sorry, yeah. Sorry for the interruption.
It seems like if I actually go through this list, it might be, I'm being generous, a fourth I might have seen, but I think it's probably going to be close to an eighth. So
okay.
I don't have
You've
enough.
Got some work to do.
Is it one of my favorite movies? I guess I'll answer it that way if that's okay with you. I don't know if I'm allowed to break a format
like that.
The question
is it the 29th best movie ever made?
The 29th.
It's not my 29th favorite film ever made, but okay. If I'm looking at film objectively, which is impossible, that seems like a reasonable spot.
Okay. James.
Yeah, I have a hard time ranking movies like the way like you would like basketball teams during March Madness, and I have a hard time even doing like a top 10 favorite movies. I can do like a list of 10, but in no real recognizable order.
He's very
order.
Difficult that way.
And
can't play along.
But there are films that I'm not personally attached to, like say we're going to like Diary of a Country Priest by Robert Bresson. Someone tells me they want to put that in the top 10 or top 20. I can recognize the importance of Bresson even if I'm not necessarily drawn to him. But with Stalker, I am personally drawn to it. If someone were to tell me I think Stalker is in the top 10, I could live with that. But if someone says it's in the top 100, I guess that's a long way of saying it absolutely could be 29, but it could very easily be much higher in my estimation.
Yeah. No, I would believe that someone actually considers this one their favorite film.
Yeah,
of
if
all
someone
time.
Says I think it's better than 8.5, I could live with that. Someone says I think it's better than Persona, I could live with that.
Yeah, that's a good way of gauging it. Like, I think, for instance, I love La Dolce Vita, Nashville, In the Mood for Love. Those are my top 10 films for sure, and they'll, you know, shuffle around. But if someone said that they thought that Stalker was better than any of those movies, I'd be like, all right, that's reasonable. I understand.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The only reason that I'm hesitant to say that it is deserving of the 29th spot is because we've already had Mirror and Andrei Rublev on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, so three movies in the top 30. It's overweight in Tarkovsky's favor a little bit. Yeah.
I think so. And we have yet to hear from Scorsese. We have yet to hear from François Truffaut. Yeah. No Billy Wilder yet, no Howard Hawks.
Here's what I'm noticing on Twitter, though, is I feel like Tarkovsky is just now being reassessed and rediscovered by a new generation of film fans. You know, there are certain directors that get brought up almost on a daily basis by hardcore film fanatics. And, you know, Kubrick pops up a lot, Hitchcock pops up a lot. And maybe I look at just Cinephilia and Beyond or Film History and Picks more often than other profiles, but Tarkovsky is always popping up, and people go crazy with anything and everything related to Tarkovsky. So I think people are finally discovering him, and they're drawn to the mystery. I think also because Andrei Rublev was hard to find for a long time, and it wasn't until the 90s you could even see the complete film. So I think he's one of those directors who's going to grow as subsequent generations devour his work.
Right. I think there is this Rublev or this Tarkovsky fervor that's happening right now.
Without a doubt.
That was very clearly reflected in the 2012 poll. I'm very curious to see where his films land in 10 years, because I don't mean to say that it's undeserving. And so much of how you rank his films, I mean, it's all the films are, they're very different, but in the same time, they're very similar. They share a lot of similar motifs. Mm-hmm. It's a lot about reconciling the presence of God or the lack of presence of God, the horrors that humans, the horrible things that humans do to each other. In the name of God, precisely. And so, I mean, we see that in most of his films. I watched the Sacrifice recently, and I have to say, I mean, I kind of prefer The Sacrifice to Stalker.
That's good to know, because it gives me a big one to look forward to.
Yeah, I mean, but that is absolutely just my personal reaction.
But going back to the list, yeah. If you were to shuffle the deck and rearrange the order of the top 50 on the Sight and Sound list, I almost feel like I could live with that list in any order, because the top 50, I think I hadn't seen four of them in the top 50. I was checking earlier. But it's just, it's an embarrassment of riches. It's a lot of masterpieces, and it's very easy to toss that word around and be casual when you're looking at all these films, but it's a lot of profound work, and trying to rank them, it's a fun exercise and a fun challenge, but ultimately I think the rankings...
It's a fool's errand.
Yeah, it's a fool's errand.
Our next topic, the end is nigh, so gather your Blu-ray collection and hunker down. Tarkovsky's vision of a post-human wasteland got me to thinking about other movies where mankind's been run out of town. We're going to talk about our favorite cinematic modes of human extinction and why there's been a slew of films and TV shows on this subject in recent years. So, to start us off, why don't we talk about a few of the most common ways that humanity bites the dust? What are some of your favorites?
Not my favorite.
Zombies and robots definitely seem to be either the machines will get us or we're going to eat ourselves.
Or a nuclear mistake. Someone had a kerfuffle at the nuclear power plant.
Or a giant rock will hit us and we'll be taken out like the dinosaurs.
Yeah, yeah.
Global warming seems to be a big one.
Yes.
Global warming, especially
the
happening.
Exactly. Yeah, the happening, the day after tomorrow, right?
Yeah, that was
another one.
I forgot about that one. Jesus.
What sucks is that it's such a fascinating topic, and it seems to be tackled by the least interesting filmmakers
of all time.
It's like, you know, our own mortality and our planet's ability to preserve life, and yet you get like these just hacks that
Roland
give us
Emmerich,
lackluster movies, and I feel like it's, you know, like we saw in Stalker, it is a science fiction or end of the world or any of these topics, they are interesting topics and they're deserving of our greatest filmmaking talents.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, but like, as we said, there's zombies, there's extraterrestrial invasion, that's a common one,
Nuclear fallout.
Right. So it's either like an external force that does it that causes it, or it's some our own hubris.
Yeah, John Carpenter talks about this with how he says there are two forms of horror, and he's like, imagine a medicine man sitting around a fire a long time ago and he's like, no, the enemy's out there, the other, like the monsters that are coming to get us. And he says the other kind of horror, which is far more terrifying, is no, the enemy's in here inside our own human hearts. And I feel like these end of the world scenarios fall into those categories as well, where we are either the engineers of our own destruction or we're going to be attacked from without. And there are so many different spins on it and so many different subgenres in science fiction that explore this. And I don't know, maybe we're more obsessed with our immortality because we do see the oceans rising. We do see, and also if we just. With the increased interconnectivity with human beings online, we're aware of each and every horror and tragedy that takes place on the planet in real time, so we're that much more aware of just how fragile and ephemeral human existence is.
Which is more effective for you guys, the one that comes internally or externally?
Execution.
I mean, they can both... They can both be very effective. I have to say, the stories where humans meet their downfall by disease, I find particularly terrifying. But I think that's just because I'm a huge hypochondriac. So
so which movie gets at your hypochondria and plays upon those fears most effectively?
Oh, I don't know. Something like Contagion is pretty scary. But I'm less interested in movies where the fall is imminent, and more so I like movies where it's about the rebuilding process.
Gotcha.
So
well, that's just the elephant in the room. Do you follow The Walking Dead or do you ignore The Walking Dead?
I am not a Walking Dead fan. I do not cable. That could be part of it. Also, I've heard it's terrible.
It is,
but I don't know.
Atrocious.
Yeah, it's got a lot of.
Okay.
I read the first probably 115 issues of the comic. I watched the first season of the show. I watched season 2 and 3 kind of intermittently, but I am not a blind follower of the show either. But I do love a good zombie story. I mean, the original Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead by George A. Romero, I revisit annually. And I love them dearly. I hold them near and dear to my heart. And those are some of my favorite visions of the apocalypse.
So what is the appeal then?
The appeal. It's something innate. I don't even know if it can be fully articulated, but something about us eating ourselves to death you can't take your eyes off of it.
I mean, because to me, the zombie craze is such a mystery to me because I don't have any place of reference. Like, I'm not a Night of the Living Dead fan per se. I haven't read any of the books that the films are based on.
The modern day fervor got started with 28 Days Later because in the 90s, zombies weren't really on the scene, weren't part of pop culture
at all.
They
weren't running either.
And then in the early 2000s, you had a couple movies and a couple comics that totally changed the game. And for the last 10, 12 years, I feel like people have been more fascinated with zombies than at any given time in pop culture history.
See, it came and went with for me with 28 Days Later, though. I didn't think it. I thought that was the high. It revitalized all of it, and now it's just back to A, overexposure. B, they're still just trudging along, crawling. Just
You got zombie walks and zombie marathons taking place all over the place, and but we're talking about like our favorite visions of the apocalypse. One thing that people absolutely should do is read the book World War Z. World War Z, which bears little resemblance to the movie apart from the title, shows the before, during, and after of a zombie apocalypse from a variety of perspectives all around the world. It's so realistic. It's written by Mel Brooks' son, Max Brooks. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in zombies, it basically explores every possible zombie scene. Because I feel like every zombie movie or show is just a new spin on the same scenario. Like, you're either trapped in a mall, or you're trapped in a house in the woods, or you're trapped wherever.
Trapped in something.
Or you're trapped in a military bunker in Day of the Dead. And it's fun seeing those spins, but World War Z explores every imaginable scenario in the span of a couple hundred pages. And I read it twice. It was an absolute blast. Mm. And scary as hail. That's the only bad word I'll say.
I actually kind of like that movie.
But there are, as we mentioned, several different versions of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
But are they all reflective of the same anxiety, or are they playing off of different cultural anxieties?
Is it anxiety? I feel like some people want it. They're like survivalists out there.
It's like a morbid curiosity.
Who are looking forward to it, and like they're building their safe rooms and their bunkers and stocking up on flour and like aspirin and
shotgun
shells.
That's interesting. This is a fantasy. Yeah, that's
without
interesting.
I think there are some people out there who fantasize about being the guy with all the supplies and we're prepared and they can kind of rub everyone else's noses in it. Yeah. I guess the question is, do you want to be one of those survivors in a post? Like, do you want to have to be growing your own food and raise your own livestock?
No.
And fending off human cannibals and things like that?
No. I want to keep living in New York where I am padded by alienation and comfort and Amazon.com and Hulu. Yeah, and just watch it from afar.
Did you guys ever read Cormac McCarthy's The Road?
Yes, and I saw the movie.
Yeah, I feel like Cormac McCarthy's The Road probably will break any survivalist's enthusiasm for a post-apocalyptic world, because it ain't fun.
It's not as glamorous as they make it out.
You're walking around hacking up things. Your son's like wasting away. It's cold.
You see baby heads on like stakes.
Yeah, or you stumble into a basement and you find there's like, you know, humans being stored for a later meal or whatever. And it was one of the bleakest, darkest reading experiences I've ever had. And so, yeah.
Have you seen the film?
I've not.
Oof. God, it's relentless. And Viggo Morrison gets naked again, so you have someone to look forward to.
He's always getting naked.
He's always getting naked, of course. But, yeah, I also think it has something to do with the fact that we are trying to appeal to just kind of international markets now. And there's something about the, you know, globalization is what can we all relate to? And we could all relate to the entire world going up in flames because it's touching everyone. It's affecting everyone. And so I think that's one of the things that is kind of playing into our mentality. And also, there is a, as you mentioned earlier with Twitter and social media and everything like that, there is a much more urgent nature to our news input. Just like something's not as important as it was 10 seconds ago. And I think there is something like when you turn all that off and you have to live in a world where we're disconnected from that and you can't all of a sudden know what's going on in Chicago, what's going on in Hong Kong, what's going on in Moscow.
Like the end of the world's end.
Yeah, that alienation, when you're alienated in a city that's used to all this communication and this hub, what's that like? What's that isolation like, that alienation? So I think, yeah, it does play into some fears, but yeah, it's definitely kind of, as you said, a fetishistic sort of appeal too.
Right, yeah. Do you think that the rise in popularity of, say, like video games and comic books, where you can build this world, and that's just kind of a convenient way to build a world where Mother Earth has taken back her rightful place, and I think it's just a convenient way to imagine, to reimagine the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think Alan Moore, the comic writer, it was a Swamp Thing comic once, he was talking about how, like, if Earth were just to shrug, then that would be the end of humanity as we know it. And I do think there is something awe-inspiring about just how little it would take to render the Earth incapable of sustaining human life. So it is kind of like it's the last great big monster. Like, will Earth basically decide that we're an infestation and needs to get rid of us? But in games and comics and everything, like world building, I do play some games where it involves world building, like in a real-time strategy games and Civilization 5 and stuff like that. There is that, you know, fascination. But I do think for every person out there who's horrified by apocalyptic stories and gets a great thrill, there are those people out there who get a huge thrill about, I'd be one of the survivors, and I would be one of the guys. Yeah. That, and like, they're doing their homework. So when they watch Walking Dead, I imagine crossbow sales have gone up since the introduction of the character Carl. Yeah. I would love to see some stats of pre-Walking Dead crossbow sales to post-Walking Dead crossbow sales. I guarantee you it's been an exponential curve in a positive direction.
Yeah, I think also part of the appeal of... let me ask you. Have you noticed there's been more a resurgence in films like this recently? Like, people are clamoring for the apocalypse more so than ever
before. It seems like it started with Armageddon and Deep Impact back in summer 98 when this came out at the same time. And it was obviously, or like Independence Day in 1995. I guess as soon as technology caught up to the point where we could paint digitally end of the world scenarios, then they finally said, now we no longer have to have the handcuffs of special effects. We can film or shoot whatever we can imagine. And so that kind of opened the floodgates to these scenarios where you get X-Men Days of Future Past and all these dystopian apocalyptic worldviews.
I mean, one of everyone's favorite sort of villain now is that cyberpunk villain. Like in the latest Bond film, it was...
Javier Bardem.
Yeah, and what was his thing is that I could just flip the world off with a switch. I think there is that fear of, even though we're so sophisticated and elaborate in our networks and all these things with technology and the way we're connected, it is kind of frightening how easily you could just flip the switch on all of it and we would just be spun into darkness and have to like rethink.
Like Hurricane Sandy, which came to New York a couple of years ago, I noticed in the span of a day how quickly people started reverting back to barbarism. We had lost our power on Monday night, and around Monday at midnight, I was out on the streets. You know, New York's a very strange place when it's dark because you can't see anything. It's totally bewildering and disorienting. And there are people standing on all the rooftops throwing like watermelons and cantaloupes at people in cars driving by. I'm like, guys, the power's only been out like 6 hours and you're already acting like you're 11. Like, relax. Like, civilization is not over. And I feel like just the slightest little nudge, like short, because, you know, New York is an island. If the people stop taking away the garbage and stop bringing us food, how long will it take us just to eat each other?
Yeah.
And it wouldn't take very long.
A matter of hours, probably. Yeah. It's so funny how incubated most cities in this world are, and if there was that slight disruption in our routine,
no food,
I'll
no internet.
Slash your throat because of it.
Right. Do you think each generation gets the post-apocalyptic vision that it deserves? So, say, in the 50s, you have the Soviet anxiety, you have the nuclear anxiety, and that continues through the 70s, basically, you get where it culminates in Planet of the Apes. And the 80s, I think you get a lot of zombie movies in the 80s, correct?
And you get remakes like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Blob.
But also people have been fascinated with the end times ever since the beginning of Greek and Norse mythology or Christianity. I mean, Christianity has the Book of Revelations, and Norse mythology has the Day of Ragnarok. And so there's always an end of the world scenario with very definable features. And I completely am mesmerized and fascinated by all these concepts. And, you know, the next Thor movie is Thor Ragnarok, yet another end of the world movie. Like, you know, so superhero movies are getting into the game as well.
Ugh,
exactly. So, and then the 90s, you mentioned cyberpunk, like the 90s with the tech boom. You have probably the most famous vision,
The Matrix.
At least modern vision of the apocalypse. You get The Matrix and you get Terminator.
Well, Terminator's 84. Terminator 2 was 90 or 91. But I think Terminator 1 was 84, if memory serves correctly.
Well, this French term that I learned in my English lit class from a professor, and it's about the anxieties of the turn of the century, how they're, you know, coming into it, there'll be anxieties, but even afterwards, there'll be residual anxieties, too, which I think that's what we're going through right now. It's a fin de siècle. I'm going to just write a...
Fin de siècle.
There we go.
Nice.
Thank you.
We finally had an opportunity for you to whip out the French pronunciation.
I'm gonna read off of Wikipedia just because I can't define the term as well, but it is a French for end of the century. The term typically encompasses not only the meaning of the similar English idiom turn of the century, but also both the closing and onset of an era, as the end of the 19th century was felt to be a period of degeneration, but at the same time a period of hope for a new beginning. It is. It's that conflict of cynicism, ennui, and just like optimism, how you're just trying to fight with all these ideas because in the turn of the century, you're afraid it's coming to an end. But at the same time, it is a notion of rebirth where you kind of reimagine yourself. But that being said, too,
which goes back to Norse mythology. Ragnarok is not the end. It's a new beginning.
But the funny thing is it's all an illusion. It's all like self-applied because we put dates and times on things. So in the cosmic scheme of things, it's just another day. And yet we put so much anxiety into it.
Where it's an anxiety of our own creation.
Yeah, exactly. It's man-made.
I do think there are people out there when they start talking about, especially some people they're prone to religious hysteria where they almost kind of fantasize about something bringing about the end times, whether it's gay marriage or whatever. And they're just like, oh, God's going to wipe us all off the planet.
And I'm
going
to go to heaven.
And they get like a weird smile on their face
gonna,
about it.
Because they're
like,
going to reap the rewards of all their efforts and their sacrifices.
And they get to be right.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's a more right. righteous thing. It's a very selfish notion, obviously.
Right, the rapture and...
Yeah, the rapture. That was the word I was looking for. That was escaping me. Right. Yes.
So, should we just count off a few of our favorite versions of the apocalypse?
Absolutely.
By all means. I actually don't really like the genre.
Yeah, Mikhail's not a huge fantasy, sci-fi kind of horror guy.
I just don't think any of them were executed at the level that I'd like to see them executed.
There are a few, but I'm a... If I'm religious about anything, it's fantasy, sci-fi, and horror.
Few and far
and
in between
yeah.
is how I feel.
I love a good escapist fantasy. But as a little kid, you know, Terminator definitely had a profound impact on my imagination as a kid. If I just hear that music and I just I picture her driving off into the storm at the end, and you hear that dun 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 dun, dun and like oh, just it's astonishing stuff. And that was probably the first time I ever contemplated the end of things as we knew it. When I was, I guess, 8 years old, when I first saw that thing, and it just it was a total eye opener. As far as the superhero movies are concerned, I did enjoy seeing at the end Days of Future Past. It was, you very rarely see superheroes even get a scratch, much less have an entire generation of heroes mowed down in front of you. And you got to see an entire future generation of X-Men hacked apart
narratively speaking,
by the Sentinels.
Though, because of the whole time collapse and things like that, they do survive.
They do survive, but you're watching in the beginning and
they're
at the
end. They're brutal deaths,
though. Yeah, they're brutal deaths. And so that was, I feel like it was the superhero genre, as much as I love it, I do admit there's a lot of room for it to grow where it needs to grow, but I feel it's a nice step forward.
I think it's one of the better
superhero films to see that vision of guys like Colossus getting pulled apart by Sentinels
and stuff like that. It really did get me at the gut watching some of them die, and also, doesn't one of them just get like burned up intimately also?
Well,
like
Iceman just gets melted,
Exactly, yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. And I also hate that character in the movies, so.
Yeah, Sean Ashmore.
Oh, God, he's terrible.
What about you, Lady B?
Well... I have to say, some of my favorite takes on the apocalypse are the wryer, more humorous versions of the apocalypse. So something ridiculous like Tank Girl kind of appeals to me.
I've never seen Tank Girl.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
I'll check it out.
It's profoundly stupid.
Lori Petty.
Lori Petty, baby Naomi Watts.
Yeah, she was a creature of the 90s who just disappeared after that decade was over. Just like her
persona
can't exist.
She's due for a comeback.
Yeah.
She'll be back.
But yeah, but comedic visions, but, like, yeah, I felt like World's End did a pretty good job of doing an end of the world.
I actually really didn't like that movie. Ooh. I thought it was just a total retread of Shaun
well,
of the
12,
Dead.
My 12-year-old brother would put up his dukes. He made me take it to see him. He made me take him to see it 3 days in a row. He just, Nick Frost just killed him. He loved it. But Shaun of the Dead wasn't an end of the world scenario, but it's definitely a zombie scenario. Shaun of the Dead I thought was absolutely hysterical as well.
Oh, World's End. I was thinking of This is the End. I actually prefer
This is the End.
I don't think World's End stands up on a second viewing. Yeah. Any more favorites?
Well, actually, the recent show, The Last Man on Earth, with Will Forte and Kristen Schaal.
Oh, I hear that's great.
I really like that show.
Oh,
and
there's someone else left. I didn't know that. You spoiled it for me.
I know. So sorry. The title is misleading, it turns out. They take this very high concept story and turn it into an examination of gender roles and take it in a very different direction than you might anticipate. Another favorite of mine is Battlestar Galactica.
That's a good one. Yeah.
The recent, updated version took a.
Wait, you don't like the first season from 1979?
Just so we're clear, I'm sure that one is fabulous as well. But it's essentially a Noah's Ark story. It's a flood allegory where we have to figure out what we value now that humanity has been wiped off the planet. We are the last vestiges of our species, and how do we rebuild from here?
I think what's interesting in is the idea that here's this cataclysmic event. Like, for instance, 9/11 occurred in New York, and for about a month or so after that, everyone was of a nationalistic ilk. Everyone had their American flags flying. Everyone was brotherly love and things like that. 2 months later, 3 months later, 4 months later, we're cynical, sarcastic, snotty, everything. The New Yorker semblance, that civilization, it comes right back on your shoulders. And Battlestar Galactica is very interesting in that regard, in that, like, we have to stay together, but then the politics rears its head so quickly again in that show. And it's, the human condition, man, it's really tough to... Really,
the last thing in Doctor Strangelove, society is ending as we know it, and they immediately start talking about their end of the world scenarios and their planning and who they're going to keep. And then all of a sudden they start immediately scheming against each other all over again. Like, sir, we must not allow a mindshot gap. And it's like, but it takes a whole 5 minutes before George C. Scott starts thinking.
Right
back into it.
Self-preservation, man. You can't beat it.
Carriage return.
Well, that was cheery. Before we give in to despair, let's have a few reminders of why the human race is worth saving. James, what's one movie, TV show, art exhibit, website, tweet, or whatever that you're feeling positive about?
But it must save the world, Jamie.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the Khaleesi Daenerys Targaryen start the inevitable saving of Westeros in season 5 of Game of Thrones in about 2 weeks. So I've read the books twice all the way through. I've seen every episode of the show probably twice as well. And I'm a Game of Thrones nerd, so I couldn't be more excited about the arrival of that show. And and then of course the inevitable publication of The Winds of Winter, the sixth book in the series, which should be due sometime this year or early next year. Hope.
Maybe next
but,
decade.
For a fantasy freak, it's a never-ending source of joy and entertainment, that whole franchise. I love it.
All right, that's something to look forward to. Excellent, Mikhail. How about you?
I don't know what kind of cheery note this is on, but I just finished reading a book about Putin since I've become weirdly obsessed with him in a way where I would love to see him perish, but if he did perish, I wouldn't have my obsession to rely on anymore and my talking topics.
Oh, man.
To hate like this is no true happiness
forever.
Listen,
I think hate is a very healthy emotion. I don't care what people tell you.
Very positive. Very good.
Written by Masha Gessen.
A new spin on positivity.
Well, you know, I'm a Russian. Listen, this is going to happen. I'm going to bring some of that real-world pessimism to the table. So it's written by Masha Gessen, a Russian journalist who's been writing for Vanity Fair and Salon and most other publications too. She wrote a book about Putin and his rise to power, and then some time after that, and the sort of some of the things that he would do to get into power, such as, you know, blowing up buildings in Moscow and blaming it on Chechens and things like that. It's called A Man Without a Face: The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. And it's she's a very good writer. It reads like a novel, and it's absolutely fascinating. If you're morbidly curious like I am, just because that's how I was brought up, by all means, check it out. She has other books about the Pussy Riot, about Pussy Riot. Absolutely. I don't know if you have to bleep that one out. I'm sorry, but in context,
the Pussy Riot's good.
Okay, good. Yes,
yeah,
I did it.
We like
I only cursed once on this show.
You should have told us we could use that word from the beginning. We'd have been using it left and right.
With context, oh, Jamie. Goodness. With context. Jesus.
All right. Well, in keeping with the theme, I'm going to pick something that I'm going to bring into the bunker with me. It's John Hodgman's 2013 comedy special, Ragnarok. James, you mentioned the Nordic legend Ragnarok. This is John Hodgman's comedy special where he morphs into his deranged billionaire persona and encourages the audience to prepare for the inevitable Ragnarok, which is set to happen at the end of his show. So it's hilarious, and it's amazing watching him convince this room full of people that they need to purchase gallon-sized jars of mayonnaise and drink their own pee. And I don't know.
I already do that, so I'm ready.
Yeah. I don't know. John Hodgman, do you guys know who he is?
Yeah.
I'm unfamiliar with this stuff, but I love stand-up, so I would love to check it out.
Yeah, he has a great podcast called Judge John Hodgman. I guess he's probably still best known as
the Daily Show correspondent.
Oh, I know exactly.
He was on the Daily Show.
He's the kind of nerdy guy with glasses.
Yeah, exactly.
He's PC Mac, Daily Show correspondent.
Yeah, he's hysterical. He was the PC in the I'm a Mac, I'm a PC commercials. He's been on Parks and Rec. He's been on 30 Rock. He was on Bored to Death.
He did the whole tour.
Yeah, exactly. So he's just generally very funny, and this special, I thought, fit in very nicely with our theme for today. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. What are some of your favorite post-apocalyptic movies? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And when the end does come, don't you want to be able to say you've done the best you could? Well, you won't be able to say that with a clear conscience unless you rate us on iTunes. Next episode, you thought this week was heavy. Just you wait. Tied for the number 29th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, we've got Claude Lanzmann's 9.5-hour Holocaust documentary, Shoah.
I am glad that I'm not a guest appearing on that one.
You guys got off easy.
That's like my go-to joke if I'm hanging out with a girl. I'm like, you want to go back to my place and just check out this 9-hour Holocaust documentary about trains? No big deal. Sure.
Someday she's going to say yes.
And that's gonna blow up in my face terribly.
All right, so better carve out some time to watch that. I expect your feedback, just FYI.
I don't think I'm ever gonna watch that. I'm not gonna lie, and it's one of those fat books that I buy like Infinite Jest and just sits on my shelf collecting dust. So yeah, thanks for having us on your show. I really enjoyed the palate cleanser. Yeah,
and thanks for giving me an excuse to watch Stalker. It was a revelation. So I'm in your debt. I can only hope I can return the favor by recommending a movie that blows your mind at some point in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
I look forward to it. All right. Thanks, Mikhail. Thanks, James. I'm looking forward to making an appearance on your show. And I hope the whole no swearing bit wasn't too hard.
Oh, no worries. And also, just a quick note, you can find me on Twitter at Colbrack, so you can find Wrong Reel at Wrong Reel. And Mikhail, where can they find you?
Well, I think everyone should know, this is an editorial note, that I've been sweating profusely because I haven't been able to have a cathartic moment and just F-bomb the entire time. But, well, you could find me, my handle is at the Karadimov on Twitter, and you could find some of my writing at betweenframes.net. But I am a part of a podcast that's Wrong Reel, and you could write an email to us at wrongreelpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we're available on every platform. Excellent. Vimeo, and Stitcher Radio,
YouTube,
and iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, and so yeah. Come hang out with us.
We're obnoxious.
Excellent. All right. All right, on that note, if you need me, I'll be in my margarita pool.
Awesome.